I'm Steve Kraske, and this is KCUR's Up to Date. With 2017 drawing to a close soon, it's time to reflect on how you spent your year. And if that wasn't at the movies, well, there's still time to see some before year's end. Today, our favorite film aficionados join us with their top flicks from the entire year. Line up your home video queue now, and just maybe you'll be caught up for Oscar nominations come January. If you'd rather go with authentic theater popcorn instead of popping at home, they can help you there too. Among films you could be seeing right now, one about a woman who has it out for her local police department, and a new mystical love story that's reminiscent of 1950s sci-fi. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. With 2017 ready to morph magically into 2018, it's time to take a look back at the year in movies with our team of film critics. We'll run down their top three picks of the year, and we'll run down the latest independent foreign and documentary films now showing. We'll do all this with that team of stupendous critics. They are film professor Cindy Haynes. Cindy, how are you? Happy holidays.
Thank you very much, Steve.
KCUR's own Steve Walker.
Steven. Thank you.
Bob Butler reviews film for the Kansas City Star. You can read his reviews 24 hours a day, 7 days a week at butlerscinemascene.com. Bob, how are you?
Doing great.
Let's start off here. The 23rd Annual Critics' Choice Awards are coming to us live on January 11th from Los Angeles. Cindy Haynes, you typically show up at these things.
I know.
Are you going this year?
I don't know. I haven't decided yet.
Oh, of course
but
not.
But unfortunately, Penelope Cruz is not going to be among
that's
the...
That's very unfortunate.
So that'll be a factor as to whether or not I go. Because usually she sends her regards to you. But,
yes.
You know.
But so if she's not going to be there, I'm not going. So let's just make that clear. Has 2017, Steve, lived up to Hollywood's reputation of releasing many of the year's best films at year's end?
Yes, they have. Okay. But several of my top three to see, you know, were just... released, two of my top 10 just released. There were good movies all year, and I was just especially loving the foreign films I was seeing this year.
And
three foreign films are on my top 10.
And the documentaries, too.
And the documentaries. I was watching a movie a night.
Oh, wow.
From some of the people who support our program and send us links to things. And... just continually blown away, and there's great movies coming out in the next month or so too.
Do you think films are they getting better with time, or if people are there formulas that are being worked out so people know better how to make a good film than a poor film?
I don't know, because you know I don't go to a lot of the big blockbusters.
Yeah, you're cranky that way.
I'm cranky that way, but I'm also, you know, I'm of a certain age, and I, you know, have a certain college degree or two, and I can't sit through Cars 3. I'm sorry. Yeah. I just can't.
Are the films getting better, Bob?
I think they are, but I'm not sure it's because of Hollywood per se. I think it's actually because of the distribution through cable and streaming is allowing movies that wouldn't have gotten made otherwise to get made.
That's a big change, huge change.
Yeah. Cindy, what do you think?
I think they're getting better. I think there are intimate movies that are intelligent and engrossing, and I'm just delighted by some of the smaller films that we've seen toward the end of the year.
Intelligence is a key word here, I think.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Well, that's encouraging. All encouraging. Yeah. Okay. Let's move on to our list of some of the films now showing later on this hour. We'll get to our critics' top three picks of 2017. Let's go to a film that's got some buzz here, The Shape of Water, Bob. It's a love story told as a surreal fairy tale about two people marginalized by society and inspired by classic sea creature movies of the 1950s. And sad to say, I remember some of those.
Two people marginalized. Well, one person at least marginalized. The other, an amphibious being. This is from Guillermo del Toro, who has a fantastic imagination. Sometimes in the past, I thought he's let the imagination run away with him a bit overmuch. Here, I think he keeps mostly all these elements in balance. If you can imagine the whimsy of that French charmer Amelie, and
a movie I still love, yeah.
And meld it to The Creature from the Black Lagoon, and then throw in a big dose of Cold War paranoia, and what you've got here is a story about a quote unquote, forbidden love. The great Sally Hawkins plays a mute young woman, Eliza, who works in a top secret lab. The time is the early 60s. The place is Baltimore. And they've got a new creature in captivity, which the scientists are nuts about, a gill man who comes from South America, where he was worshipped as a god by the natives. They want to study him to see what he might have, what he might be able to tell them about long-term space travel. This is, you know, we're trying to get to the moon before the Ruskies, right?
Right.
Sally Quinn's character, a mute, realizes that she can communicate with this guy through sign language. That's the only way she can do it. And pretty soon, a love affair develops. She gets together with her best friend, her gay neighbor, who is an artist played by the great Richard Jenkins, and her co-worker, played by Octavia Spencer. They spring the man from his prison, and, well, love blossoms.
See, and I think Guillermo del Toro is one of those incredibly talented, imaginative filmmakers who is changing the way movies are made or the kinds of films that are being made. We cannot expect to go into a movie of his and watch a traditional narrative movie. He's got so much more going on, such an imagination, and he's so talented.
And that's exciting, just by
it
itself.
It is. Yeah. So here's an example. You're saying, are they getting better? Yes, every time this filmmaker makes a movie, it raises the level for
If I have any qualms about this, it's that I think his love of the grotesque, he leans on a little hard here. The movie's a little bloodier and violent, and that fights against the whimsical elements I was talking about in the romantic love interest.
And it's graphic sexually, as you can imagine, considering it's an amphibious
interspecies
creature.
Sex, yes.
Right.
Okay. But
Del Toro mentioned that as a kid, he saw The Creature from the Black Lagoon, which came out in 1956, made such an impact on him that he felt that the movie should have been also a love story. And so he decided, well, I didn't get the film I wanted. I'm going to make it.
Steve Walker, what did you think of it?
I liked it a lot. And the thing about the love story, she not only teaches him sign language, this creature, she first communicates through hard-boiled eggs that she brings to lunch. And the creature's like, never seen a hard-boiled egg. Love them. And then she brings
How could anyone love a hard-boiled egg?
She brings a record player and plays old music.
Jazz, yeah.
And we must say Michael Shannon, as great as Jenkins is, Michael Shannon gives another great performance. His villainy is a little tired, I think, at this point. He's always kind of a scary villain, but he's good at playing
a
scary villain. But he has a taser, and they kind of treat this creature very badly, abusively.
I've only seen the preview for this film 89 times based on the films I've seen this fall.
Well,
so I've seen a little bit of the great
Sally Hawkins, we have to say.
She is great.
She was in Maudie earlier this year, which people just fell in love with her again.
I'd put money on Sally Hawkins being nominated for an Oscar.
Oh, gosh,
for the
absolutely.
And I'd like to give a shout out to Doug Jones, who beneath those prosthetics creates an actual character. And believe me, this costuming that got him in is just astounding.
Astounding, yeah. Yeah, it's very effective.
You're all three very positive about this film. Did it make any of your top 10 lists for the year?
Absolutely. Top 10.
Not mine, no.
On mine.
Okay, so two of the three.
We do not have a clip today because
they're
neither one of them speak. So we had trouble finding any kind of clip at all.
That would be an issue, wouldn't it?
Yeah.
For when it comes to clips.
For radio, it is, yes.
So three thumbs up for The Shape of Water starring Sally Hawkins. We'll be hearing more about her probably come award season next year. Okay, Steve Walker, let's move on to a film titled Kaleidoscope. It's a psychological thriller about the bizarre relationship between a middle-aged man and his obnoxious mother.
Well, the man is played by Toby Jones, who people will know he was in one of the two Truman Capote movies. He was in Infamous and played Capote. They'll know his face. He's in movies constantly. And Anne Reed, a great British theater actress, she doesn't do a lot of films. She plays his mother. They have a weird, strange relationship. He's very much of a loner, lives in a housing project in Britain, in London. And then he invites a woman over. He meets online. But I don't know what is really going on.
You don't. He believes that he wakes up. This woman is dead in his bathroom, or so he thinks.
So we think, yeah.
And then his mother knocks on the door for a visit, so he's got to juggle body parts with mom. But the whole thing is it all in his head?
Right.
That's the ultimate question. And the fact that I don't know at the end, is the problem with the movie.
I agree 100%.
It was written and directed by Rupert Jones, who's Toby's brother. So it was designed just for him. It really comes off as a grade B horror film.
Two great performances, and I have to say that it's very similar to Norman and Mrs. Bates.
Yes. Well, I would actually say three, because I think the young woman who, Shanae Matthews, who plays the overnight guest, it did a terrific job, too.
So you don't know at the end of the film if this was a dream or reality.
Or a crime.
Or a crime.
Right.
Or a crime.
Or a projection. Or a wish.
Or was anybody killed at all?
And that's not to say we're giving anything away, because it shifts tone pretty early in the movie. It goes, is he imagining this? Did this really happen? The bathroom's now clean. It was bloody. I mean,
well, that strikes me as a tremendous omission. I haven't seen the film, but why would you do that?
It's a bit of a narrative cheat. If you can pull it off, everybody tells you how brilliant you are. And if you don't, they talk like we're talking.
That's a very good point. I agree. No clip for this either, as well. Their people are very quiet. But Anne Reed is terrific as his horrible mother.
Have you seen her in that Netflix series, Last Tango in Halifax?
I have not, no.
She's wonderful in that, opposite Derek Jacobi, as people who marry late in life.
Ooh, interesting. I want to see more of her work.
Just to review then, this film was titled Kaleidoscope. Would you recommend it or not?
No.
Not vociferously.
Okay.
Is that a word?
There might be better picks out there. Is that safe?
That's nice. I like how you said that,
So maybe not so much enthusiasm for Kaleidoscope here. Okay, let's grab another one here before we go to a break. This one is titled Wonder Wheel, Bob. It's Woody Allen's bleak take on life on Coney Island back in the 1950s. It stars Kate Winslet.
There are two kinds of Woody movies. There are funny Woody movies, and then there are serious Woody movies. And by and large, the serious Woody movies don't usually work. Here's the problem. On occasion, Woody has made a serious movie that's also a comedy, like Crimes and Misdemeanors. Brilliant stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But this is in the vein maybe of his interiors. The setting, Coney Island, the 1950s. And the one thing I will say about this is Vittorio Storaro's cinematography.
Gorgeous.
It's like a CinemaScope dream come to life. Everything is more colorful and bigger than life. It actually makes Coney Island, a very tacky place, look magical.
Right.
All right, so you've got a housewife. Her name is, what is her name? Ginny, Kate Winslet. She's pushing 40. She's married to Humpty. The name tells you all. Humpty is played by Jim Belushi. He runs the carousel. They live above a shooting gallery, so their entire life is punctuated by gunshots.
Oh, my God.
And as miserable as everything is, it's about to get a little bit more miserable, because Humpty's daughter, a grown woman named Carolina and played by Juno Temple, has run away from her gangster boyfriend and is seeking shelter. She arrives at the same time that Ginny has started an affair with a hunky and preposterously, intellectual lifeguard played by Justin Timberlake.
Who was the wrong actor for the part.
Totally awful. The wrong actor.
A hunky intellectual, and it's Justin
and
Timberlake?
And he's not that hunky.
He wants to be a playwright, and he's always dropping, you know, literary allusions.
O'Neill,
which coming out of his mouth, you go, huh? But anyway, here's what it all comes down to. When the daughter starts to fall for the lifeguard too, Ginny goes nuts. This is like, you know, middle age crisis in spades. Ranting, raving, the whole nine yards.
It's very William Inge or Tennessee Williams.
It's like come back little Woody.
William Inge, I'd say first, because he already did his knockoff of Streetcar Named Desire with Blue Jasmine.
Right.
Which he owns completely.
Which is one of his serious movies
really worked. One of his best movies, right. This is so bleak, like you said, Steve. It's
shrill.
It feels like a it's stagey. There's not one laugh in it whatsoever.
Wow.
And as if this woman wasn't miserable enough, she has a 12-year-old son who's a pyromaniac and sets fire to his therapist's office. That's how...
The allusion to Coney Island, I mean, it is set there completely immersed in it. But you remember in Annie Hall, his character grew up underneath the roller coaster at Coney Island.
And also in Radio Days.
The Cyclone.
In Radio Days, that was a factor too, Coney Island.
I don't think the film's going to attract anyone but a hardcore Woody Allen fan.
I am. But when he makes a movie that doesn't work.
Well, let's do this. Let's listen to the clip we have here, Bob. Set it up, then we'll come back and talk about Woody Allen a little bit more.
This is Jim Belushi as Humpty getting apoplectic that this daughter he hasn't spoken to in years has suddenly shown up with gangsters on her trail.
I was 20. I didn't know better. I'm sorry. Why didn't you go to the police?
I told the police too much. That's the problem.
Why the hell you open your mouth?
The police told me that I could be looking at 5 years if I didn't cooperate.
What the hell do you know? Since when do you know what happens inside the rackets?
How could I not know? I can't be married to one of those guys and not pick up on what's going on.
Jesus Christ! I told you not to marry that racketeer! I told you he was all mobbed up. He staked a murder. She found this greaseball exciting. He wasn't even good looking. He was a punk. I need a drink.
Forget it, Humpty.
You need more time, damn it.
We're going to go to break, and we'll be right back. Welcome back to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. We start next week with a look at the ultimate White House insiders. It's a conversation about White House photographers and their iconic images. That's Monday on KCUR's Up to Date. Well, this hour we're talking with our indie foreign and documentary film critics. They are Cindy Haynes, Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. And we were just sort of wrapping up a film, Wonder Wheel. It's the latest from Woody Allen. We were talking about how bleak it is. And we surprised, is Woody's reputation waning, soaring? Where are we here, Cindy?
Well, he's always been known for doing such an excellent job of casting his films. And I think this is one of the biggest mistakes he's made.
Mm-hmm. That's a good point. I loved Interiors. You mentioned that as his bleakest movie, for sure. Very Bergman-esque of two. But last year he made Cafe Society, liked it. The year before, a movie that I can't even remember that was terrible. The year before that was perhaps Blue Jasmine.
Yep.
As someone said recently, if the year ends in a number, we have a new Woody Allen film. He just works and works and works
but
and works and works.
In a way, I got to... If you look at the Woody Allen canon, at least two-thirds of the movies are definitely worth your time.
Yes.
Maybe half of them are better than that, and maybe a dozen of them are world-class cinema.
Right.
He has a deal where, in fact, I interviewed him years ago. I said, what's your process? He says, my process is I make movies so cheaply they're not worth a studio head getting involved.
Oh, that's interesting.
Yeah.
And that's what he does. Every year he makes a movie cheaply.
Well, think of any scene in Manhattan and you go, okay, that's indelible cinema.
Yeah.
And there's several other examples. I agree with you.
Okay, that's wrapping up Wonder Wheel. We're getting not a lot of enthusiasm for that one either. You might want to skip it this holiday season. Okay, how about this film, Disaster Artist, Cindy? It's an account of the making of The Room, considered by many as the worst movie ever made. It's become a cult classic.
I really didn't know what I was getting into when I started watching this movie. I hadn't read much about it, hadn't seen any previews, and it is one of the funniest movies I've seen in a very, very long time. It's bizarre. James Franco is one of the quirkiest actors, I think, working today. He comes up with some absolutely ridiculous films, but he also is a very talented actor and does a great job playing a guy named Tony Wiseau.
Tommy. Tommy.
In this film, which is a look at the way this movie, The Room, was made. I believe, is it Armor shows?
The Screenland shows it, yeah.
Screenland shows this movie
once
on a regular
month,
basis because it has become such a cult classic. And the guy who made the film wrote a book called The Disaster Artist, My Life Inside the Room. And Dave Franco... who was actually James Franco's brother, plays a part of this Tommy's best friend and the guy who's trying to help him get this movie made. And so James Franco said that they were curious. They had three questions about this fella, Tommy, and nobody really knows where he's from because he's got the quirkiest accent you can imagine.
Mm-hmm.
But they never knew where he was from, how old he was, and how he got the $6 million to make The Room. And this is their story about how it got made.
And we get to see at the end clips from the real The Room, which is, and I've seen more than those clips, it is really awful.
Oh, I actually went out and I spent $13 to get a DVD of The Room before going to see The Disaster Artist.
Huh.
I would have to say it enhanced my pleasure immensely because when you watch The Room, you go, how did anybody, what was this guy thinking? And then you cut to the Disaster Artist, the scene where he has to make an entrance and say one line, and they're on take 65, and you finally understand why they used that take, as terrible as it was.
Mm-hmm. He couldn't do it.
Seth Rogen was one of the producers of this film, and he has a part in it too, and which keeps the humor rolling.
We're going to hear a clip. I believe it's them just talking about getting together and bonding and making this movie, and you'll hear James Franco, and Dave's in this clip too, but James Franco's accent. When people ask him, where are you from? He always says New Orleans. You will hear how preposterous that is when you hear him talk.
This is from The Disaster Artist.
The Room.
The Room. Nobody read it yet. So today, you'll be first one.
I can't believe it, man. You did this.
And of course, you play Mark.
But you want me to play Mark in this?
Nice big role. Secondly.
Well, yeah, it's a huge role. Are you sure?
You don't want to do it. Fine. Maybe Johnny Depp available.
No. I want it. I want the role. I'll take it.
It's like you say, Hollywood reject us, then we do it on our own.
Okay.
Can you hear that New Orleans lilt to his voice?
A little bit.
What you need to do, people, if you're interested in this movie, is listen to James Franco's interview with Terry Gross. Last week.
It
was really good, and he talked about how much he kind of feels enamored with this man for his
passion,
seeing his dream
and
through
for his
to
passion.
Realization.
He said that, you know, you can have a passion that might work, you might have a passion and never realize it. So.
I get the impression this film is something of a crapshoot, that some people are going to like it.
Yes.
A lot of people are going to be disappointed.
It's very funny, though. It's very funny.
But it's hit and miss based on your own sense of humor.
Franco said that Wiso was a cross between a vampire, a pirate, and Michael Jackson. So if you could imagine all of them together in this
It's quite
character.
A mashup.
Okay. Sort of pretty positive reviews
positive.
For a Disaster Artist. Okay.
It was on my 3 to see last week.
Okay.
Yeah.
How about a film that I think a lot of people are going to like if they haven't seen it yet? It's a film with Missouri in the title, so it can't be all that bad, right? Three Billboards Outside of Ebbing, Missouri. It's about a woman consumed by grief. Answers to questions concerning her daughter's death, Steve.
And that woman is played by the great Frances McDormand. This movie was written for her by Martin McDonagh,
and
who's an Irish playwright.
Handles it with
aplomb. She's a killer, yeah. And Martin McDonagh was a great playwright. He was making plays that were just terrific. I've seen several of his plays in New York and London. He was my favorite playwright for a long period. And now he's written this movie about a woman whose daughter is raped and murdered, and she's tired of nothing happening.
Mm-hmm.
Not that the police are dragging their feet. There's just not anything to go on.
Mm-hmm.
So she puts up three billboards that says basically to Chief Willoughby, played by Woody Harrelson, raped and dying. What's the next one say?
Still no arrest or something
still
like that.
Still no arrest. How come, Chief Willoughby?
Yeah.
And it's on a road that nobody even goes by very much.
But it gets a whole lot of attention.
It gets a lot of attention. Mm-hmm. And she is so terrific. There are scenes in this film. Think of, you've seen it, Steve,
yep.
The when he and Harrelson and McDormand are talking at the police station, and he's sick, and we know this really early on.
Mm-hmm.
The scenes go from absolute rage and to tenderness in the scene when Woody coughs in her face. If you remember that scene, they were at each other like pit bulls. And he coughs, shoots a little blood on her face, and she says, "It's okay, baby." That scene killed me.
Even though she has this antagonistic relationship with him. You know, this is the funniest movie ever made about grief. We haven't mentioned how blisteringly hysterical funny this movie is.
It is very funny.
And you don't see the rape and murder of the daughter, just for the record. It sounds rough to begin the conversation here, but you don't see that.
Now, the part was written for Frances McDormand, and that's one of the things that makes this work. It is not predictable. You will not figure this is not a standard narrative film.
Utterly not predictable.
But it truly, Bob made a very good point. It is about grief and the loss of a loved one, and it is very, very powerful.
We haven't even mentioned Sam Rockwell, who almost runs away with this movie, playing a racist detective, policeman, who by the end of the movie has redeemed himself in ways that I never anticipated.
Yeah, well, exactly. It's
you wonder how many Oscar nominations this film's going to get, because Frances McDormand will probably get one. Woody Harrelson is terrific.
Sam Rockwell
Peter
will
Dinklage
probably get one.
Is in
there's
it.
Just
he has
a lot of good stuff.
Just want to make a point here. There is no such place as Ebbing, Missouri.
No.
Yes. It was filmed in South Carolina.
Which is why the mountains are twice as big as the ones you're used to in Missouri.
Right. What's the clip we have?
The clip is McDormand and Harrelson talking about... What are you doing? My daughter's been dead 9 months. Do something.
From three billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
I'd do anything to catch the guy who did it, Mrs. Hayes, but when the DNA don't match no one who's ever been arrested, and when the DNA don't match any other crime nationwide, and when there wasn't a single eyewitness from the time she left your house to the time we found her, well, right now, there ain't too much more we can do.
Could pull blood from every man and boy in this town over the age of 8.
There's civil rights laws prevents that, Mrs. Hayes. And what if he was just passing through town?
Pull blood from every man in the country, then.
And what if he was just passing through the country?
If it was me, I'd start up a database. Every male baby that's born, stick him on it. And as soon as he'd done something wrong, cross-reference it, make 100% certain it was a correct match, then kill him.
It's a good movie.
It's so good. And I want to mention, too, Lucas Hedges, who was nominated for an Oscar last year for Manchester by the Sea. He played Casey Affleck's nephew. He's really great as her son. There's so many good performances in this. And again, the tone will zigzag from laugh-out-loud comedy to something so tragic and ugly. But it's all done with such class.
What I appreciate as I get older is something that is as roundly unpredictable as this film is.
No,
so many films you've seen 100 times. This film,
you've never seen this film.
People I've seen it with have gasped.
At which scene?
I'm not going to say.
Oh, okay.
Maybe several of them. Okay. Yes. Three thumbs up, four thumbs up for three billboards outside of Ebbing, Missouri. Steve, let's go to Lady Bird, a coming-of-age movie inspired by the life of the writer and director Greta Gerwig.
Greta Gerwig was the indie it girl for several years as an actress. She now currently is in a relationship with Noah Baumbach, who's an independent film director. I loved everything about this movie. She grew up in Sacramento, went to high school in the early 80s, and it's about a girl's senior year in high school in 1982.
I think it's 92.
Oh, 92, is it? I'm sorry. Yeah. And she is just trying to get through life. Her family is pretty dysfunctional. She has a love-hate relationship with her mother, and a great performance by Laurie Metcalf, who's terrific. And Saoirse Ronan, the Irish actress who's 23, who's had 2 Oscar nominations in her young life, we'll get another one for playing the high school girl in Sacramento, California.
Boy, does she have a future.
You would never know in a million years.
Buy stock in her today.
This woman is, this young woman is Irish.
No.
And she's a drama geek, which I loved. Metcalf and her scenes also talk about that zigzag of tone. They're fighting like cats and dogs in a thrift store, and then they find a dress they both like, and it's like, love on.
Yeah. No, the mother-daughter relationship in this is so right on that women all over America are going to go, that's us.
Exactly.
Been there, done that, seen that,
The other thing I love is that there are just little throwaway moments in this that are almost absurd. But, for instance, the football coach who has to take over from the drama teacher at school who's had a mental breakdown, and how does he block scenes with X's and O's on a chalkboard?
Mm-hmm.
The kids are all Sondheim geeks, which is funny.
Every line, though, that comes out of Saoirse's mouth, I envision coming out of Greta's mouth. And I personally would love to have seen Greta in that role. Rather than giving it to someone else.
Well, yeah. A little age problem there, but...
Yeah. Greta Gerwig has made quite a splash with this film, both her writing and her directing.
What's the clip we have here, Steve?
This is a breakfast with the family, basically. Tracy Letts plays their dad, and they're having breakfast.
Why can't I just make the eggs?
Because you take too long, you make a big mess, and I have to clean the whole thing up.
Eggs aren't good for the environment anyways.
What?
You heard her.
Quickly, please.
Look at all these pictures. Every newspaper looks like USA Today.
Shelly and I are trying to be vegan. That's the soy milk.
You wear leather jackets.
But they're vintage, so they don't support the industry.
They aren't done. There's white stuff.
You know how much you love brambles? Pigs are smarter than him, even.
I never thought brambles was a genius, okay? Mom, the eggs are not done.
Fine, make your own eggs.
I wanted to. You won't let me.
Sister doesn't like me.
I'm hungry.
She does.
There's your chance. Go to bed.
I've quoted that scene about making your own blanking eggs a couple times to people because I just laughed my head off.
Good film.
Metcalf,
film.
So good.
Yeah.
She's in a hot year, too. She just won a Tony on Broadway this past year. Roseanne's coming back, which won her 4 or 5 or 6 or a cartload of Emmys. She's great.
Yeah. Okay. Cindy?
Just want to mention for our listeners from Lawrence that it'll be showing at Liberty Hall this weekend.
Let's do this. Let's talk about your three to see, the films you would recommend seeing this week that are out there right now. Then we'll go to a conversation about your picks for the best films of 2017. Steve Walker, what do you have for what people might want to
see? I could give you 6 to see, but I'll do my 3. Shape of Water, opening today, and that's at the Fine Arts and the Tivoli is all. I was surprised at that opening. 3 Billboards and Lady Bird.
Okay. Great list.
3 Billboards, The Shape of Water, and Lady Bird.
Was there any disagreement? You could have just said ditto there. Yeah.
Ditto.
Really?
Really?
Yeah, absolutely. Those are the
something. Is this the first time this is
happened?
They're
all terrific.
If you were to go from
this is the apocalypse. Yeah.
If you were to go from Friday night, Saturday night, Sunday night, if you were to see these 3 movies, you would have the best movie going weekend of your life.
That's something to say, but I kind of agree.
Well, you're just leaving me breathless and speechless here. I can't believe it. Okay, let's go to a different conversation now. Let's go to your picks for the year's best films. We asked our critics to pick their top 3. Cindy Haynes, what do you have on your list for the top 3 best films of 2017?
And I'm not talking about disaster films. I'm not talking about huge blockbusters. But for me, if a film cannot be replicated on a stage, if it uses the fascinating elements of cinematography and art direction in an intelligent, brilliant way, I'll love your movie. And that's how I felt about Dunkirk. It was a very, very powerful film, and I shed a tear or two as I watched it. It's probably, for me, one of the best anti-war movies I've ever seen.
I didn't see it, and I'm kicking myself.
It's
now
coming back.
When you say that, yeah. Okay, it's going to come back
to theaters. Yes,
huh? Because it wasn't here long.
No. It was here most of the summer, I think, but it's getting some Oscar buzz, of course. And...
Okay.
But another point I want to make is that we mentioned our 3 to see. We're talking about relatively low-budget independent films are the ones that are rising to the top. I mean, there were some other really good action movies this past year, but these are films that a lot of people haven't seen because they're shown at the art house cinemas.
Did Dunkirk not do well?
I don't know. I don't know.
That was one from your year's best. We have 2 other ones. What else do you have?
3 Billboards outside Ebbing, Missouri.
No kidding.
I was very surprised by the film. I kind of expected another Fargo. No, it's not. And I've seen it more than once, and it does hold up.
Yeah.
And then Ingrid Goes West. This was one of the most entertaining films.
Remind us what that was.
Well, Aubrey Plaza plays an unhinged social media stalker who moves to Los Angeles, and she hooks up with Elizabeth Olsen, who is what's called an Instagram influencer. Mm-hmm. And it just ridicules the whole social media impact on young people and on culture, American culture.
In a very intelligent way. It's on my top 10, actually, too.
Ingrid Goes West.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
What a great pick that is. Yeah. Bob Butler, it's come to you.
Well, I'm going to start out with Get Out. which to me is a movie that revolutionizes the horror and suspense genre in the same way that some Hitchcock movies did, in the same way Psycho did back in the day. It's a horror movie with a social conscience, and I think people who are now working in horror movies, and I got a daughter who's one of them, they are all working under the influence of this film and what it pulled off.
And what's the plot of it?
The premise is a young black man and his white girlfriend go to upstate New York someplace to have a weekend with her family, and he discovers some really ugly secrets about what's going on in this lily white community.
A little bit of Stepford Wives.
Although
they're very upfront about how liberal and supportive they are of Obama and all of that, too.
Yes,
that has to not be unsaid.
If somebody wants to see Ingrid Goes West or Get Out, they can. Where can they go
Ingrid
see it
Ingrid Goes
now?
West, I think, is...
It's on Netflix.
Is it on Netflix yet? I know it's at Redbox, for sure.
And Get Out, I'm pretty sure, is all the...
Get Out's on HBO.
Okay, HBO.
Okay, so Get Out is one of mine. Three Billboards has got to be another one. That's pretty awesome. My third one is a film that doesn't open here until just after the first of the year, but it blew me away so much. Call Me By Your Name, a love affair movie unlike anything I've ever seen. The delicacy and the intelligence. And there's that word again. Just stupendous.
What's the plot of that film?
Well, you have a professor, his wife, and their teenage son. He's digging up artifacts in, where are we?
Northern Italy.
Yeah. And a graduate student, played by Armie Hammer, comes to spend the summer working with him. And the teenage boy and the grad student realize there's an attraction. But this isn't your typical coming out story. It like defies all the conventions. It's pretty amazing.
Call Me By Your Name.
It's
is
beautiful.
The name of
that
film.
Heartbreaking.
It comes out in January. Yeah, okay. Great picks. Steve Walker.
Well, my number one came to Netflix just this week, and I'm so happy to report that. The Unknown Girl is my favorite movie of the year. It's by the Belgian filmmaking brothers, Jean-Luc and Pierre Dardenne. This movie, in a nutshell, it's about courage and humility and guilt. In the form of a young woman who's a doctor in a poor neighborhood, hears her doorbell ring, and they've been working 12 hours. They're done. They decide, we're not answering it. We're done. The woman who did buzz that door is found dead the next day. And so the young woman doctor does everything in her power to give back to the neighborhood in one sense, to find out who this girl was, so her death isn't in vain. It's just amazing.
The Unknown Girl. Interesting.
Yeah.
What else is on your list, Steve?
Well, also on my list is The Big Sick.
Good movie.
Written really by Kumail Nanjiani and his wife, about their story when she got sick. And he was a stand-up comic, and him trying to connect with her family. Mm-hmm. Her parents, played in the film by Ray Romano and Holly Hunter, played very well.
Mm-hmm.
It's a great movie about feeling like an outsider, because his family wants him to marry a woman from India as well. And him struggling with how to love the woman he loves and not let his family down.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And I would add Lady Bird. When I walked out and the PR rep was there, what did you think? I said, I've loved everything about this movie. And I'm watching it again Saturday with some friends who haven't seen it, and I'm looking forward to seeing it again.
Oh, that's great. Great. Well, great picks. Great picks. Yeah, Cindy.
One of the points I want to make, to pat ourselves on on our backs, is that we hope to alert people over the course of the entire year to these kinds of movies. I mean, mm-hmm. we talk about very special films at the end of the year, but that's kind of our job. I mean, we're charged to do, independent foreign documentary films. And if we can alert you to them in advance and get you to go out and see these films, we're going to see more and more of these kinds of films come to Kansas City.
Yeah.
So, there's a lot of good stuff coming up. Over the holidays, The Darkest Hour with Gary Oldman is just phenomenal.
The Post. Churchill story during World War II. Right?
The Post.
Phenomenal.
Mm-hmm. I like The Post a lot.
I, Tonya, is, Steve, one of your favorites?
The Post is the Washington Post story about publishing the Pentagon Papers.
Right.
And
I'm not a fan.
I like journalism. You weren't a
fan.
No,
I think it's really bad.
Really?
Yeah.
But you liked it.
I liked it a lot.
No,
I
Tom was, Hanks is terrible as Ben Bradley.
I will admit that Tom Hanks is miscast in this, but that's the only thing about it I didn't
Streep's
like.
Great. She studied Katharine Graham.
Yeah.
As I studied Katharine Graham when she was alive.
Okay, we'll have to thank our critics for all their work this this year and for their picks, which we'll post online later on today. You can find it at kcur.org in the up-to-date site. I want to thank film professor Cindy Haynes, KCUR's Steve Walker, and Bob Butler. Again, you can see his reviews at butlerscinemascene.com. Thank you all very much. Happy holidays.
Thank you. You too.
Take care.
Here we are, 10 days till Christmas, halfway through Hanukkah, and maybe you're still looking for that perfect gift for your favorite sports fan. But don't worry, a Fans Notes commentator Victor Wishna is back to tell you what he really, really wants.
Well, 'tis the season, as they say, the most wonderful time of the year, when so many of us look forward to getting what we say we've wanted. And I'm not just talking about the Franklin American Mortgage Music City Bowl. Go Cats! Last year, at this time, I started a tradition of sharing my own Kansas City fans wish list. I didn't know it was going to be a tradition, but, well, just like my 3-year-old who points at every toy out he sees, I didn't get everything I wanted. So, if you'll indulge me, I have just a few more items. I want the Kansas City Chiefs to maintain the poise they seem to regain this week, as they flattened the Raiders in one must-win division game, and prepare for another this Saturday night. I want the Chiefs and their fans to remember this is the same team, more or less, that steamrolled the Patriots and outdueled the Eagles. I want to see KC make the playoffs, win their first postseason game at home since Joe Montana, and, on their way to a Super Bowl, stomp all over the Pittsburgh Steelers. Or, even better, not have to play them. I want the Royals to go all in on a rebuild, even if it means losing 100 games, just like the Cubs and the Astros did. I mean, for like a year or two, not 30. I want to go to spring training. I want Gianluca Busio, the 15-year-old phenom that Sporting KC signed this fall, to blossom into a bona fide star. In good time, of course, like when he's 16. I want a nice digital camera. The kind that isn't a phone. I want this to become something of a hockey town, because now that the Missouri Mavericks have rebranded as the Kansas City Mavericks, why not? I don't know that much about hockey. It feels like I should. I want the NCAA to disband. And, well, when that doesn't happen, I want them to enact bylaws that allow student-athletes to earn a living wage or to profit from their own likeness. Barring that, I want 10% of every coach's salary set aside for a pizza fund. I want a new pair of Converse All-Stars that look really old, the kind that slip on, that have elastic instead of laces. I don't have time for laces. I want Twitter to just stop. I want everyone to know that we have a semi-pro women's tackle football team, the Kansas City Titans of the Women's Football Alliance. When their season starts in April, I want to make sure to remember the Titans. I want to see the new Star Wars movie. I want more funky events like motocross and monster trucks and professional bull riding downtown. I want the streetcar to extend to the Truman Sports Complex. I want the Jayhawks to turn it around. I want... The thing is, with sports, there's always a long list. It's why we keep coming back. And perhaps more so this year and next, sports play an important role as both a distraction and a call to action, a form of silly entertainment and a forum for civic re-engagement. Sports is a reflection of what we want and what we need to do better. And I don't want that to change. I want it now.
Victor Wishin is a writer, editor, and sports fan. He lives in Leawood. You can find us on Twitter. We're at KCUR. Up to date, follow me at Steve Kraske. They document history in a way no one else does. On Monday's program, a look at the ultimate West Wing insider. It's a conversation about White House photographers. The great Bobby Watson composed our theme music. We had help this week from Linda Scher, Steven Steigman, Danny Alexander, Luke Martin, Kathleen Pointer, and Justin Garnett. Have a great weekend, all. I'm Steve Kraske, and you are up to date.